Hello. Thank you for the invitation. I will speak about uranium mining in general and a little bit about Sweden too. But there will be another presentation focusing on Sweden later. When you want to mine uranium, you first have to find it. That means you have to drill. But that's already where the problems are beginning. Here, for example, this company in Texas failed to reclaim their drilling holes and the mud that was produced from drilling, and they got this notice of violation. So when real mining starts, it might look like this. This photo was provided to me by Miles 19 years ago. The mine doesn't exist any longer. This is another open pit mine and combined underground mine in France, now also closed. This really looks like a moonscape. Or here a very large open pit mine in Namibia, the Rössing mine, that is kilometers. The length of the mine is 2 kilometers, depth 230. It's still in operation. And it's the mine, the ore that is mined there is very low grade. Only to give you a figure, it has 0.029% uranium. That's not a lot. You see these little toy trucks there on the left side. We still have to go closer and closer. That's really, even for a dinosaur, it would be too big a toy. So these are really large amounts of material that are carried out of this mine. In this case, more than 1 billion of tons of material, and about 1/3 of which was processed for the uranium contents in it. If the ore deposit is located too deep underground, you have to apply underground mining. Here an example from Czech Republic, now being dissolved. This is a diagram of the process of uranium mining, because some people don't see what exactly it means to mine uranium. First, you have to take the ore out of the underground that contains the uranium. That is the ore is the rock containing uranium. And to get access at this uranium, you have to remove some overburden, some low-grade material, so you get several kinds of wastes illustrated on the right-hand side. And these wastes usually are multiples in volume compared to that what you carry out in form of ore. Then this ore has to be processed to get at the uranium itself. Since uranium is only less than 1%, maybe 1 in 1,000 1 in 1,000 or something like that, or in Rössing even less than that, you virtually get the whole mass of ore shows up as a waste, in this case called the tailings, uranium mill tailings, and only the small fraction of uranium that is contained is virtually the product of the uranium mill, and this is what is being traded on the world market and processed into nuclear fuel in further steps not discussed here. So before we actually get the uranium, we already have three kinds of waste we have to deal with, and these are millions and millions of tons. For example, low-waste rock piles in eastern Germany, from the famous Wismut operations. Meanwhile, these have been relocated in a former open pit. Or here, low-grade material that was treated for residual uranium by heap leaching. That means sulfuric acid is percolated through the pile, catched at the bottom of the pile, and then the uranium is extracted from the liquid. This is an operation that has taken place in Hungary, is now being dissolved, and that is looked how it looked in the large size. And there's a residential area on the right-hand side just next to it. I'm mentioning this since low-grade material is something that is gaining importance, processing of such materials, since high-grade deposits are not often found. And since there's a lack of uranium, more and more low-grade material has to be processed, and this technique might become applicable for future operations once again. It's not a thing that can be left to history. Most of the uranium ore is processed in some uranium mill for extraction of the uranium. This is an example from New Mexico, USA. That's a large operation, and it produced a total of 50,000 tons of uranium over a period of nearly 30 years, and it generated 30 million tons of uranium tailings kept in these basins on the left side of the background, covering an area of 140 hectares, and other hectares were used for evaporation ponds and other ponds. The tailings have the form of a slurry when they are delivered from the mill. And here's another example from Eastern Germany. Now you might say, what's the problem? The uranium has been extracted, but we already learned from Gordon in the presentation before that there are some decay products accompanying the uranium. Here we see them once again, given with the activity per gram of tailings material for some typical tailings material. So this is the uranium, the contents of the decay products contained in the ore. And what we take out during processing is just the uranium. So most of the activity still is contained in the tailings. Okay, after a few months, these two at the bottom have decayed away, but this is the situation we are facing for tens of thousands of years. 80% of the 85% of the activity is left, and this has to be dealt with, and this has a very long half-life of 80,000 years. So you should take some precautions for yourself and for the future. So what was actually done in the first years of uranium mining, it was simply dumped in the environment. This is an example where this was done in Gabon, Africa, by a certain French company named Kojima. Now it has changed its name to Areva. And they spilled 2 million tons of this material into the environment until 1975. That's remarkable, this date. That they continued is so long. And when the mill was shut down in 2003, they simply covered the spread material over this was spread over the landscape. They covered it with some neutral soil that will be washed away within a few years because of the high rain in the area, rather than collecting it and disposing of it in some safe way. In most cases, the tailings are dumped in some form of impoundment. Here's a very famous one in the United States, the Atlas tailings in Moab, Utah, containing 10 million tons. This photo is taken during the operational phase. And I will come back to this one later. Now, let's talk about what the hazards are from these deposits. The first problem is of a physical nature. You wouldn't believe it. It has nothing to do with radioactivity. It's just that these tailings impoundments are usually built in a very weak way, and they tend to collapse just for cost reasons. This is made in such a way. And this has happened several times. This one was in 1958 in Kyrgyzstan. Over 600,000 cubic meters of tailings spilled into the environment, flowed down the river. A town was destroyed, people were killed, and the tailings spilled 40 kilometers down the river. Who names the cost of such a disaster? Or here's another example from the United States in 1979 in New Mexico, where 1,000 tons of slurry and 400,000 cubic meters of contaminated water spilled into the environment and into the next river. Now, I hear you saying, well, yes, you cannot compare the situation in Sweden with poor Kyrgyzstan or proud America. We are here in the home of the Volvo. Have you forgotten this? Aitik, near Gällivare, copper mine by Boliden, famous Boliden company. What you should see here is some dam across the image. What you see is a small section of a dam and a lot of mud. Of course, such things don't happen in Sweden. Even worse was the disaster in the mine in Spain, owned by the same Swedish company in Aznalcolar, where a zinc mine experienced a much worse disaster with the tailings dam. Now, about the radiation hazards. One is gamma radiation. This applies only to people standing on top of the tailings, so it's not the most dangerous thing. It doesn't often happen so often that somebody is staying there on top. But it's already different with dust. Dust containing radioactive material or toxic substances, for example, such as arsenic, a case we have in eastern Germany, for example. This can be blown over larger areas in the surroundings. Or even more dangerous, radon gas is continuously formed within the tailings, and a part of it is released into the environment and can be transported over large distances, such as thousands of kilometers. This is just to illustrate. For the people who are more in figures, I have the following picture here. It gives the radiation doses for somebody living on top of a tailings pile, radiation from external radiation doses from external radiation and from inhalation of radon. And for the case that you are living in some home built there, or that you are standing outside, or some average calculated for the whole year or for your lifetime, so you get, these are figures for years, so you get astronomical high doses for people living there. So you might say, well, who might consider constructing a home there, but think 30 years into the future and this will be forgotten. There are so many cases where, you know, it has forgotten there has been some deposit somewhere and it was used later for other purposes, and then only they found, oh, we made a mistake. But it's not only people who are living on top of the pile who are in danger. It's just for simple residents living downwind from a uranium mill. This is a model calculation for a typical uranium mill in the United States. Calculated with generic data used by the Nuclear Regulatory Authority, the Commission, and it turns out that in 1 kilometer downwind, you have a radiation dose of 2.5 millisieverts for residents this per year. So these people would have good reason to sue the company since the 1 millisievert dose constraint is exceeded. Once the mill is closed, you still have emission from the tailings pile, that is the middle bar, and only once the tailings are covered, there is a real diminution of dose. But now we are still talking about people living now. What about all those people who will breathe the radon that is exhalated over thousands of years? How to assess this? This is tried here in some collective dose calculation. Over long periods of time, over large areas around the mill site, and then it's compared, this collective dose is calculated for the whole legacy left from nuclear fuel use. So all steps of nuclear fuel use are included in this calculation. And surprisingly, the only two factors coming to greater figures here are the uranium tailings and the reactor releases of carbon-14. This is the long-term effect of reactor operation. And surprisingly, the major portion of the future radiation dose is caused by the uranium tailings and not by the reactor operation. This lower bar corresponds to 23 deaths that are caused in the long term by 1 year of reactor operation that is operating now. And only if the tailings are covered by some means, but how do you want to cover the tailings for thousands of years in a safe way? That's virtually impossible. If this were possible, then the total dose would be much lower, and then, only then, the reactor operation would contribute to the major part. So this is very important to keep in mind, and the calculations like this have led the United States to adopt a very thorough program to deal with the tailings they had left over from the Cold War era. Okay, we understand. We do need some form of cover. Here is a very large, the largest in Europe, tailings pile in eastern Germany. The camera was too small. It extends about three times the size here to the left and the right. And the black material are the tailings, and all the water is covering more tailings. This total is 2.5 square kilometers. And 1 year later, or 2 years later, they started installing some preliminary cover. It's not yet the final cover that's being installed now. And as I already told, in the United States, some cover, sophisticated cover has been developed that is meant to last at least 1,000 years. That is still short compared to the longevity of the hazard, but it's still already some progress in thinking of the long-term consequences of these tailings. So they need several layers to keep the water out and to prevent radon exhalation and so on and so on. And about the number of tailings was reclaimed according to this procedure. This is the one we saw in the beginning. This looks now like this. And has been applied to several other places in the United States. Well, this is, of course, an expensive operation to deal with tailings. And in Canada, for example, companies and governments say, oh, we cannot do that. That's too expensive. We need something cheaper. And so they invented the water cover disposal for tailings. Water, in fact, limits radon exhalation of the tailings when it's at least 1 or 2 meters deep, but that's all. It does not provide some physical protection. It's difficult to maintain in the long term. How do you want to keep this water level at the right level for thousands of years? And it causes permanent seepage. This is an example, the Quirk Lake tailings and Elliott Lake, with a total of 46 million tons covering almost 2 square kilometers. And this is what it looks like from the aerial view. I don't need to tell you where the tailings are located. And that leads us to the next hazard to be discussed, that is seepage from the tailings. Here's an example in Hungary. There are 2 tailings piles covering 1 square kilometer each in southern Hungary. And there's a permanent seepage of tailings fluid. And there's a drinking water well of the city of Pécs nearby, a city of 170,000 inhabitants. And you see these colored areas near the piles. This is contaminated groundwater. And they have installed now some reactive barrier to prevent this contaminant plume to progress towards the drinking water wells of the city. But the problem is not yet solved. It's just beginning this, that they are dealing with it. And now back to the Moore Butard tailings pile. This one is located on the bank of the Colorado River, which supplies drinking water to millions of Americans downstream. And there's constant seepage from this pile into the river. And there's a hazard of flooding. If there's some high water, then part of the tailings pile might be washed away. The company had to set aside $10 million for some application of some cover. And then it turned out, we cannot reclaim this in place. It should be reclaimed, it should be relocated to some safer place, since this problem with water and the river cannot be solved here in place. And this is now going to be relocated to a site about 50 miles away, and this will cost at least $300 million that have to be paid by the taxpayer. The current U.S. government this year or last year, suddenly they said, yes, we don't have that money at the moment. We do need it for other vital purposes, and this will be prolonged until 2028 now, this operation of relocating this tailings pile. We are waiting. So if disposal on ground poses such a problem, wouldn't it be a solution to dispose of the tailings in some open pits? Here's an example from France. where this was done in a former open pit mine in the Limousin area in central France. This was in 1992 when it was in operation. This is what it looks like now. Well, there's still this depression, so rainwater is coming in and seepage water is flowing in and it has to be catched. That is done here in this case. So this has to be pumped and has to be treated in the long term. That is no permanent solution. Well, in Canada, they still say, that's too expensive. You have to have something that is cheaper. And in this case here, that's in Key Lake, Saskatchewan, they say, yes, we can dump it in groundwater. So do you think, how is it possible this will contaminate the groundwater and the surroundings and you don't believe it? Well, we apply some layer of very pervious materials below the tailings and then put the tailings on top. So the groundwater has no reason to go through the tailings. It will walk around the tailings and so it won't carry the contaminants with it, and so there will be no distribution of contaminants. So whether you believe it or not, even in Canada the situation can get worse when a certain French company becomes involved, here called Kojima, or now Areva. They said, why this pervious layer? That's too costly. We just dump the whole shit in the pit and everything will be fine since the surrounding rock is more pervious than the tailings and we don't have to worry. This shows the cost, reclamation cost. This is from a study done for the German Ministry of Economics about more than 10 years ago. So it's not really up to date, but quite interesting. Shows the cost of reclamation of these tailings experienced in various countries where such data is available. Not all countries are shown here for that reason. And expressed per pound of uranium oxide produced at these sites. So you find there is a huge range for these costs. Depends on a number of factors. One is whether some legacy was found, as in United States, those Cold War sites, here called Title I sites, or in Eastern Germany, where some giant government operation was started to deal with this old legacy waste. Or in other cases, for example, Canada, you can't see the bar because it's so small here. Now we know why. We have seen why. The standards are quite different that were applied in Canada. And so on. There are a number of other factors I cannot report here. But maybe you miss one country here. And you see there is some space left. What about Sweden? What is your guess? Those who know, please keep your mouth shut. For the others, some background information. The size of the pile in Ronstadt is comparable to that in Spain, in Andújar, southern Spain, about 1 million cubic meters. The standard applied is also comparable to Spain. Well, of course, in Sweden everything is more expensive than otherwhere in Europe. Let's say 7 or 8. What is your guess? I don't hear anything. No guess. Well, in fact, it doesn't fit into this scale. The Swedish figure is highest worldwide from this study of $40 per pound uranium produced. Of course, this has some reasons, but I will not discuss now. There are other presentations. You have all these high-ranked scientists here from Sweden. I will not interfere with these. But I only wanted to keep this in mind. Now, another method of getting at the uranium is not digging the ore out of the ground, but injecting some reagent into the underground and pumping the liquid that dissolves the uranium back to the surface, called in-situ leaching. I don't think this method is going to be relevant for Sweden for geological reasons, But more and more uranium imported from various sides of the world is gained by this method, and therefore you should know a little about it. In Czech Republic, we had one site operated in this way. That is, the photographs are taken from this one, where 4 million tons of sulfuric acid were injected into the underground. And hundreds of millions of cubic meters of groundwater were contaminated, and they are now trying to deal with this, and they don't get it managed. This is another operation of this kind. This is in Uzbekistan. At the moment, there are large new in-situ uranium mines being installed in Kazakhstan. This is particularly important since the EU countries are encouraged by Euratom to make contracts for supply with Kazakhstan. Well, to get the uranium out of this liquid, you have to have some processing plant. This is an example of a small one in Texas that was opened recently. This in-situ leaching technique only works if there's some permeable layer of some sandstone layer where the uranium is located, and it should be not too deep, maybe 200 meters. And it avoids some hazards from conventional mining, but it produces new hazards, in particular the one of groundwater contamination, and that is the thing that usually happens, that also clean groundwater layers become contaminated from several failures that can happen through these operations. In the case of the Czech Republic, there were about 30 million cubic meters contaminated in the layer, in the uranium layer zone, and 230 million cubic meters of groundwater were contaminated in the clean upper clean groundwater layer. And they are now trying to clean this up. It's a quite impossible job. Well, it turned out that, for example, in the United States, there are quite a number of operations using this scheme, that it's impossible to return the groundwater to background quality. And that is what all their licenses stated as a requirement. They should restore it to background water quality. Well, meanwhile, the authorities have found some way to deal with this matter. They say, yes, we have to loosen this requirement somehow, and we define some categories of use, and so if it was usable for industrial use and still is usable for industrial use, then it's okay. So this first phrase marked here, groundwater has not been returned to background quality, and the last phrase, it has been restored to the statutory and regulatory requirements, they seem to contradict, but this is the situation. The regulator in the United States recognizes it is not possible to restore it. So all these new mining companies coming in can rely on this. Haha, we don't need to clean it up. Even worse situation in Bulgaria, for example. After their in-situ leaching stopped after the Cold War era, they simply demolished all the installations and left the groundwater untouched, no cleanup operation at all. Well, here it is, the material we have been longing for all the time, the yellow cake. It's not always yellow, some chemical forms are grayish or greenish, but this is the material that is being traded worldwide. Here we see the map of the annual production in 2005. Surprisingly, only 62% of the actual demand is being mined. The rest is coming from other secondary resources. These are depicted here, and the most important secondary resource at the present time is the recovery of bomb-grade material for use in nuclear fuel. But this is based on contracts that will end in 2013, and then we are facing a serious supply gap. You cannot see here. There should be some gray. It's not shown here. So unless something very strange happens, this will have to be filled by actual mining. The green bottom color. So you see, within a few years, production for mining will have to double just to fill the actual demand, without speaking about reactor expansion and what other expansions there may exist. And this is what the uranium price did in turn. It exploded from about $7 per pound in 2001 to now 113. That is the short term, the spot price. Not all uranium sold at the moment is sold at this high price. But this is very characteristic that the market participants are aware of the shortage. Well, what is the reaction of the uranium mining companies? Some are considering or starting to mine deposits that were thought unminable under previous conditions. For example, the Rössing mine we saw in the beginning. They are going to mine this brown area where some low-grade material is found. So this will extend the mine life for about 8 years at least. But when they are processing low-grade material, this means they will produce or generate disproportionately more amount of tailings. So they are planning to expand the tailings deposit by another 3 square kilometers. Then new companies are emerging, looking for uranium deposits in various parts of the world. This one is in Namibia, and was licensed at breathtaking speed and opened operation last December. The Lange Heinrich mine, located in the Namib-Naukluft Park. The environmental movement there is very weak and could not prevent this to happen. This is what it looked like last year while the mine was constructed, and within 2 years, the whole process of licensing and construction of the mine and mill was completed, something that elsewhere may take 15 or 20 years. But these countries like Namibia are so relying on economic activities that they don't mind about all these environmental or other problems that might arise. Now the same company is trying the same in Malawi with another site that is going to be in operation end of next year. And more companies are looking in Namibia, drilling in this case. The Trekopje deposit is being prepared for mining end of next year. And for the mine, there will have to be built a new water supply, since there is not enough water for the mine available in Namibia, and they will build a huge desalination plant on the coast for this mine only. Surprisingly, these companies have no problems getting at the necessary money for these developments. The only problem they have at the moment is to carry the money away that they are getting from the investors. After a 20-year-long decline of the uranium industry, exploration activities for uranium are booming now worldwide, but it's unclear whether this will result in sufficient production in time. One point is clear, however, that with the mining of decreasing ore grades becoming economically viable, the environmental impacts of uranium mining are likely to increase. And here we are back in Sweden. There's one very interesting deposit in Sweden. Maybe you are not aware. There's several of these deposits in the world, and this is data taken from an IAEA report, International Atomic Energy Agency, looking for low-grade deposits that might become interesting in the future. And there are three of them mentioned by name, and one of them is Ranstad, with a total of more than 250,000 tons of contained uranium. Depends on how you determine it. You can also arrive at 1 million if you define it in a different way, of a grade that is only slightly lower than what is currently processed at Rössing in Namibia. And the new part of Rössing that is going to be mined will be similar to that. So don't think that doesn't concern you. And there's some wording, some very interesting wording. I want to read it word by word in this report by the IAEA. While the black shale deposits represent a large resource, they will require very high production costs, and their development would require huge mines, processing plants, and mill tailings dams, which could certainly elicit strong environmental opposition. Therefore, the black shale deposits represent a long-term resource that will require market prices in excess of $130 per kilogram uranium to be economically attractive, assuming environmental opposition could be overcome, which is by no means certain for any of the three deposits mentioned above. The economic criterion is already met by a factor of two. The price is already twice that given here, when you express it in kilograms, dollars per kilogram. So you see, the world is watching you. Thank you for your attention.
Does anyone have a burning question? Yaran.
Do you know if there are any estimations about how much oil or oil equivalent is getting used in the whole process of getting the uranium? Because as we hear today, they say, oh, it's so clean. No oil is involved in this clean processes.
I cannot say the figure here at the moment. I have another presentation for questions like this. I do have another presentation for questions like this. I don't have it on me now. But it's at current conditions, it's the CO2 emission, if you are asking for this, is some percent, maybe 5% of what would you have if you would generate the electricity by a coal-fired power plant, for example. But if you are thinking of more and more low-grade material being mined, you might end up somewhere where it becomes comparable, the CO2 emission from the uranium mining to that from electricity generation and coal power plant. We are not yet at this point, but it is something that might happen in the future.
Okay. this present price of uranium, how much more expensive becomes nuclear power compared with the old price from 2003 of $10? Is that 1 euro cent per kilowatt hour, or what would you estimate?
It's even less. I haven't calculated for the current high price yet, but when you have something like $20 per pound, then you arrive at a few percent, maybe 5% of the total electricity cost. So if you have now 120, you have to multiply this by 6, so maybe 30% of production cost. But this is only the spot market price. The bulk of the material is still being sold at maybe $20 per pound because of long-term contracts.